The Nature of Dragons, by Arthur Rybak. If you have any feedback or comments, please email me at arthurrybak@proton.me. My email can be found in the audio drama's description. Chapter 2. In the morning, the boy's bones are brought back to the tower by the tower guards, along with the man in whose possession they were found. They place Russell's bones in the family crypt, and Solana sleeps beside them as often as not, unable to bring herself to part with what's left of the boy for any span of time. This is her fault, all of it. If she hadn't sent him home alone, he'd have never been captured by the Faithless. He'd have never tried to escape, would have never run out into the street in the middle of the night.
"We was going to use him in our negotiations," pleads the Faithless. "He's around 40, stout. We wanted..." "It was an accident. He was never meant to get hurt. There was a struggle. The door wasn't properly shut. It was an accident."
Accident or no, the man still loses his head. Publicly, in the middle of Main Street, for everyone to see. Solana, normally one to avoid executions, attends and watches every moment. She expects the rolling head, the oozing body to make her feel better. It doesn't. The guilt, the anger, the shame continues to squirm under her skin like some infestation.
"It was my fault," she tells her elder brother Thomas,
who'd returned home from whatever hunt their father had sent him on for the funeral and execution. Thomas doesn't meet her eyes, just shrugs. "You're a Mordeth," he says, "and Mordeths can't help but accumulate sin." Then Thomas leaves. Returning to his task and leaving her once more alone with their father, Sullivan Mordeth, the great lord of Chosa. Her father stops training her, stops talking to her, stops looking at her. "I do not blame you," Sullivan says when she comes to him, weeping, begging for forgiveness. "But I do need you to leave Chosa." The next morning she wakes, enters the city, goes directly to the seamstress, then she waits with her box, sitting on a bench in the main square, until the tower staff reach the end of their shift. Then she returns home. Solana climbs the winding tower stairs up to her bedroom where the sun, reflecting off the rows of gem-embroidered gowns hanging in her open wardrobe, bathes her room in glinting light. The sight fills Solana with a deep, all-consuming longing. She shakes her head and moves to her dressing table. She unbraids her long, dark hair, her moments swift and methodical, taking no time to examine or think or mourn. From the back of the lowest drawer, Solana pulls a pair of sharpened scissors and chops her hair off in great clumps, afraid that if she stops, she won't be able to force her hand back to it. For a moment, the image of her father wandering the tower's dark halls alone overwhelms her. What will he do without her to turn to for comfort? Cutting off that line of thought proves far more painful than cutting off the hair, even though it's laughable, this tenderness. The great Lord Mordeth stopped showing his children affection the day their mother sacrificed herself. Now, with what had happened, he doesn't need her affection. Solana knows this. And she reminds herself she doesn't need his either, even though it's a lie, even though it's the one thing she's always wanted. She gathers the locks of hair into a sack, glances back at the vanity. Does she need anything else? She rummages through a drawer until she finds her heating cage. It's her favorite of her father's gifts, a minuscule replica of a birdcage, no larger than a coin, dangling on a chain, with delicate golden bars and a tiny warm flame at its center, rendered almost invisible by the sunlight. Rising, she drops the cage into a pocket of the saddlebag that lies, open and waiting, at the foot of the bed, and moves around it to the other side of her room. Solana takes the large box she'd acquired from the seamstress earlier that morning and places it on the bed. She unties the green bow, but doesn't open the box. First, Solana removes her gown, taking great care to hang it with the others in the wardrobe. Then her corset and petticoats, putting them into their respective drawers, and pulls out a wide length of peach-colored cloth which she pins around her chest, winding it over her breasts three times until they are bound so tightly to her breastbone she can barely breathe. Then she returns to her bed, lifts the lid off the box. From within it, she takes a blouse and trousers, followed by a jacket. She puts the clothes on slowly and methodically. Dressed, she stands there, hands still, even though it feels as though they should be shaking. Clenching her palms into fists, she turns to face the mirror. An older version of Russell blinks shyly back at her. She shakes her head, banishing her brother from her mind. No more time now for reminiscing about a life never lived. The sun will soon begin to set. She needs to be well on her way if she wants to remain alive long enough to fulfill her purpose. And what a great and honorable purpose it is, risking the fate of the world by waking the White Lady, and all to earn her father's forgiveness. The Church, when it speaks of the White Lady, speaks of death and destruction, of lands turning into oceans, of mountains sinking back into the earth, of starvation, deprivation. They say that people will be trading in their souls for a loaf of bread, and Solana is going to find her. And why not? If she can help cleanse her country, why care about the rest of the world? What has the rest of the world done for Chosa? The Mordeths have never been accused of suffering from great honor, and after everything, she is still a Mordeth. And maybe her family is uniquely responsible for Chosa's predicament. After all, when Chosa had been under siege during the Nurak War, her great-grandfather had chosen to abandon the city to invaders from beyond the Great Wall to the south of the lands. He should have stayed. Should have fought. Instead, he ran like a coward. At least that's what Solana's father always said. Her great-grandfather had abandoned his people to live under Nurak rule for two generations. Only for his grandson, Sullivan Mordeth, to return from this self-imposed exile and reclaim the land. The battle for Chosa lasted 6 months. Thousands upon thousands of Chosa's citizens had died in the fighting, in the siege. But eventually, Solana's parents had won, and the Nurak were expelled from the tower. In return, they had unleashed their foreign curse upon the country. Was it any great surprise that as a result of all this there were faithless among the population? That there were people who missed their old masters, resented the great Lord Mordeth for reclaiming land he believed he rightfully deserved? It's not as though her father's rule had brought with it joy or prosperity. The very opposite, in fact. Her brother is right. The Mordeths, it would seem, are unable to avoid accumulating sin. What's one other to add to their ever-growing pile? She knows her father's going to hunt her down. Or rather, send Thomas to do it for him. Sullivan is going to hunt her down, drag her back, and force her to marry Marcus. But first Solana is going to wake the White Lady, save her country, even if this act will destroy the rest of the world. Solana shakes her head. Her eyes shudder. Picking up her saddlebag, she looks around the glowing room once more. She closes the wardrobe doors. The round room goes dark. Later, a lad named Sel knocks out the stable boy and steals a black gelding belonging to the Lady Mordeth. He walks it out of the walls of the Black Tower so calmly that no one thinks to stop him. He looks familiar, after all. Beyond the tower walls, he rides slowly through the overpopulated city. He crosses the drawbridge at the gates of Chosa, where the city guards let him pass, barely glancing at his travel permit, even though he's going in the wrong direction, what with only 3 hours remaining before sunset. He rides right past the door station just beyond the city's ugly iron gate, and breaks out into a gallop. Back in the city, a bag full of thick brown locks is delivered to the wigmaker, with a golden mark for the woman's labor, and a simple handwritten note saying, "To be gifted, not sold."